This is a PlanetPhilip.com podcast.
Before this interview starts, I'd like to explain a couple of things. Firstly, the recording stops at approximately 32 or 33 minutes. There was a problem with the recording, and suddenly, for no known reason, the voice stops. We actually recorded a video, and the video continues, but the voice stops. Secondly, for some reason, the system didn't use my proper microphone, and it sounds like I'm shouting in a bathroom. So my voice quality is terrible. For both of those things, I'd like to apologise. But anyway, here's the recording that we do have. Hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to another PlanetPhilip.com interview. With me, I have three special people from the old days. Joining me today is Randy Pitchford, Matt Armstrong and Patrick Dupree. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hello.
All right, now for those listeners who have been living under a rock or just been playing games and don't know anything about who you guys are, could you introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Matthew Armstrong. I am a designer at Gearbox Software. I've been here for a very, very long time now.
I'm Patrick Dupree. I'm a programmer, lead programmer here at Gearbox, and I've been here for maybe just a teensy bit longer than that.
I'm Randy Pitchford. I'm the president of Gearbox Software. I guess I've been here since the beginning. Also, just entering the room is one of my partners, Stephen Ball, who is... go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, Stephen Ball. I helped start the company with Randy, and I was one of the artists...
Okay, one of the artists.
Yeah, Stephen's humble. Stephen did almost all of the weapons in Opposing Force, probably all of the soldiers in Opposing Force.
Yeah, and some of the creatures.
Some of the creatures, I mean, from built, textured, modeled, animated, the whole bit.
Oh, the whole works. Yeah. All right, so let's start at the beginning then. So how did Opposing Force come about?
Let's see, so... Steven and Brian Martell and Rob Hieronymus and a couple other guys, Landon Montgomery, and I sat around my dining room table and we were thinking about projects that we should do. And Half-Life had just come out and was awesome. And we thought, wouldn't it be neat to go into Black Mesa as one of the soldiers? And wouldn't it be neat to take that point of view, a character that we imagine from the get-go needs to be a villain, and when we put him in this situation, he becomes just like Gordon, where he prioritizes human survival, his own survival, and mankind's survival, and takes up the fight against these aliens.
Okay, so what, you just picked up the phone and said, "Hi Gabe, I got an idea."
That's actually exactly what happened, yes. I called Gabe and said, "Hey, I've got an idea." And he said, "Cool, why don't you come up and we'll talk about it." And so I think it was myself, Rob Hieronymus, and Brian Martell, and we went up to Seattle. We talked to Gabe and a few of the other guys about it. They were really excited. At that time, they didn't even own Half-Life, actually. Sierra owned Half-Life, so their attitude was like, "This sounds good, and we believe you guys can do it. You're going to have to drive down the street to Sierra and convince them, though." So we drove down the street to Sierra Online and talked them into it.
So they had the final say about whether it was made or not?
Back then, yeah.
All right, that's cool. And then when did you start hiring people? Or was it just you four guys that started making it? Or when did Matt and Patrick get involved?
It was five on day zero. It was actually five people. So Stephen Ball, Brian Martell, Landon Montgomery, myself, and Rob Hieronymus. And before we'd even got offices, I started talking to people I knew and getting some folks. So the first guy that joined us was Mike Wardwell. He's actually employee number one of Gearbox, the first non-owner. And Mike's just down the hall, but he's kind of busy right now, so we decided not to disturb him. He was there before we even had our first temporary office set up. Patrick Dupree joined us from Ion Storm. Patrick is sitting here on my left very early in the process.
Yeah, I saw Randy's plan file update talking about jobs at Gearbox. So back when clan files still existed, before blogs.
Yes, before we had the web, we had the Unix.clan command.
Okay.
Finger command that would allow us to look at someone's .plan, which would be their basically the text equivalent of a blog back in the day.
Right.
Alrighty. And you guys just sat down. I mean, you started with just an idea from the viewpoint of a soldier. I mean, what else did you pitch to Sierra at that point, or just the basic idea?
Mostly what we pitched was the five of us were good at making games, and we were passionate about it, and we could execute. So that was probably the biggest factor in the decision-making process on their side. But, the idea of playing from the soldier's point of view is obviously an interesting little twist. We wanted to have the character kind of mingle in with the events that we saw from Gordon's point of view, but also, you know, he has to have experiences of his own. So, you know, we had a few things sketched out. As it felt like they were receptive, we got to work on planning out our ideas and designs, and I wrote a design document, which probably in the entire history of Gearbox is the most, that starting design document is the most accurate reflection of what the end game that we shipped turned out to be, which is weird.
Okay. So, Matt, I mean, you're currently lead game designer. Were you a lead game designer at the time of Opposing Force?
No, I was just the guy. I was looking for something in the industry in the Dallas area, and I saw that they were nearby, so I just called up and said, you know, do you have a position or opportunity? And I came up for an interview and brought up some work I did for Half-Life, because I've been working with Valve for a while up until then. And Randy really liked what I showed him. I showed him some single-player work I've done just as a sort of example, and a couple multiplayer maps I did that were popular at the time. And then he showed me some Opposing Force, and I thought, yeah, these guys know what they're doing. They were already rolling by the time I got here. And I got picked up pretty quick that day.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Matt, like, right out of the gate. Matt had made some Team Fortress maps that as kind of fan work that myself and a lot of the people loved. But he was working with Valve. He'd helped build Team Fortress with those guys, so he already knew a lot about the tools and the capabilities, and what was neat though was his Half-Life map was clever. I mean, it felt perfectly in line with what you'd expect in Black Mesa. It had a brilliant puzzle that I'd never seen before or contemplated, and so, you know, I knew right out of the gate, I'm like, wow, this is a designer I want to work with.
Okay, so, and was that ever released, that particular level?
No, never.
Would you be open to it being made available?
I wouldn't even know where it is. That was over a decade ago.
Yeah, I know, but I got to ask, huh?
It's also the level design equivalent of a sketchbook. It wasn't so much a complete beginning, middle, and end level as an environment that had some kind of sketches of clever puzzles and ideas and situations that felt really right in the Half-Life universe. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I had a general design and a plan for what would be a one-man entire expansion pack for Half-Life,
mm-hmm.
which is a starting point. And then I picked two or three key elements or events that you have to get right for this to sell, because you have to hold yourself to a high standard. And if you can't get the key moments right, then there's no point doing it. So I basically was able to present Randy the best parts and not show him all the terrible things that I would have built later.
That's contrast with the Team Fortress classic maps that he had had, which were finished shippable, like shipped things, which were amazing and done. You know, so I got to see both ends of it, and I ran right at him.
And did any of those ideas end up in Opposing Force?
Probably bullshit.
Well, with Opposing Force, not really. Maybe a little Blue Shift, because I when we got to Blue Shift, one of the things that I was asked to do was to tram ride at the start, and my the reason Randy thought I should be the guy doing it is because the thing I brought him started with a guy on his way to work where the accident happens. Because I thought the thing I was working on was, imagine if you're working at the town outside of Black Mesa when the accident happens. So, I mean, that's skipping on to Blue Shift, but when it came time to do the train ride for the start of Blue Shift, Randy asked me what I would do with it. My response was, well, Opposing Force was very much showing off the tag and showing off the cool stuff and the awesomeness. So for Blue Shift, I would probably make it really, really mundane. I mean, it's about Blue Shift is a regular security guard. He's not one of the elite, cool, awesome guys. He's just a guy. So he'd probably go to work. He'd probably have to start at a bus stop and go past the laundromats and the apartments and the places where guys just sit around and do boring stuff. And fortunately for me, Randy said, that sounds awesome.
What was sticking to me, you know, when I'd set the intent of Blue Shift into motion, I started with the premise, hey, you know the part at the beginning of Half-Life when Gordon's first on the tram and right off the bat he rides past Barney knocking on the door trying to get in?
Yeah.
Okay, this game, you're that Barney, you're standing there knocking on that door to get in, and that's where the game begins. And that was the simple starting point kind of premise that I threw out there that kicked off Blue Shift. What Matt did was said, hey, how did Barney get on that platform? And he had an imagination for that, and he had Barney as the guy in the tram that was right in front of Gordon's. And he also had us coming from farther out in the facility, because that first room, that was where Gordon's journey began, but we never saw how he boarded the tram or where the tram was before that moment. And had it imagined that, he'd taken us out of Black Mesa and had us go inside of it. And he had, you know, so the idea was a lot better than just, I think it should be really mundane. But that's a...
All right, cool. And Patrick, I mean, tell me some of the things that a lead programmer would do. I mean, I'm presuming it's things like the rope climbing and stuff like that, but what else?
The rope climbing is the one thing Patrick didn't do. He probably...
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, because I, on the, with Opposing Force, I did pretty much all the AI for it. And whatever was associated with it. I worked with Steven a lot and animation, and I did a lot of the weapons work.
That was tricky, too, like things like the barnacle.
Yeah.
And like we had some really wild and inventive weapons in Opposing Force. And, you know, between you and Falconberry, like, you guys knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun working on that stuff. And I at least had some familiarity with the code, too, because it was based on... the Quake stuff, which I had been using at Ion Storm for Anachronox. So yeah, it was just a lot of that kind of thing. But the ropes were interesting because that was the one thing where it was kind of a, you know, something we hadn't worked on up to a certain point. So yeah. We had a couple other programmers here at the time that were working on their own tech. So they got co-opted off of that for a little bit to work on the rope tech.
Yeah, well, these guys, Sean Rudin and Steve Jones, who I... noticed immediately as being incredibly talented, having amazing brains, but having never done anything in the industry before. So they joined the studio, and I thought the best strategy there would be to give them something that's a technical challenge that will ship in the product if they succeed, but if they fail, the product doesn't depend upon it. And so the challenge, Steve had a really advanced understanding of physics for that time, and solving open link chain physics, such as what you would have in a rope that was a physics simulation, and having that interact with player input and player movement seemed like a really difficult challenge, but an achievable one in a short time frame. It was really about the intellect and less about like typing lots of lines of code. And so, but also if it didn't work, it could be cut or it could be simplified to something like a stiff ladder kind of approach and still would have worked if the level designs depended upon it. So I gave that one to Steve and Sean and said, have fun with this one. And if you pull it off, the game will ship with it. And it was cool. They gave us a new feature to the Half-Life engine that didn't exist before they did that work.
Yeah, they nailed it. So how much of the stuff you guys worked on actually made it into the games as a percentage?
Almost all of it. I mean, there was this one chase scene with the pitworm where it was chasing you through the tunnels and stuff. That was probably the most significant part of the game that we cut because we had we worked on it, and we got it to a certain point that just wasn't quite working out the way that
really ambitious.
It was pretty ambitious.
So if you remember, I don't know how well you remember Opposing Force, the Pitworm was the giant single eyeball thing that was in that sewer.
That really horrible scream.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, I think because we cut that boss fight got a lot better because we had more time to spend. The animations you did, Stephen, were freaking amazing and perfectly synced with... Stephen Ball did the animations for that guy, and it was perfectly synced with the logic that Patrick was able to write. So as I was like, as you're trying to avoid it by hiding in the corridors, it's like smacking in through the doors with its claws trying to get at you. It was really terrifying. But yeah, there was a moment where you beat it and you basically flush it down the toilet, which means it wasn't dead, and the whole floor would collapse, and you'd end up in these tunnels, these sewer tunnels, and it would be chasing you, crawling through the tunnels. And
cool.
The idea was you'd be running away, or maybe you'd be on the back of a tram-like device and shooting off of the back of its deck. But you know what killed us on that? We wanted the tunnels to be round.
Yeah, BSP.
Oh, really? The BSPs? Okay.
Can't be round. It wants to be squares.
Did you ever consider having that as the boss battle?
It was a two-stage boss battle. So we focused then, as we pulled back away from the tunnel component, there was other problems with it too. Like, it was just going to be exciting, you know, but mostly it was going to be a rail ride. So it deserved to be cut. It wasn't going to be that great. But because we cut it early, we put all of the development attention that would have gone on that back into the Pitworm itself. So that first half of the originally designed boss fight became the entire boss fight, and was really gratifying. And then I solved a lot of it in level design too. Like, I think you defeated it by going around that map and finding, you know, some, you know, different levers to pull and
the
different.
Valve in here.
Yeah, the valve. You had to pull the valve and turn on
the gearbox.
That's right. I was being snarky. And so you beat the boss with level design gameplay. So I solved it. I solved it in level design. I did a lot of solving problems level design. Remember the power loader?
Yeah.
There was a moment where we were
and
originally we were going to drive the power loader around. I think I'm even in an interview somewhere promising that you're going to interact with it in some way. And driving the power loader wasn't going to work out. So I created a little puzzle in a room that Rob had built, but it was largely empty at that point. So I created a puzzle where the power loader comes into the room and Landon did the animations I needed. And that was a zero code puzzle. That was an entirely level design driven script, which satisfied the goal of interacting with that power loader, but not going as far as the drivable thing we'd first imagined. What's that? Yeah, it was totally last minute. It was like, I did that, Landon came in with me to do the animations, and that was like a solid, probably 2 16-hour Sunday and Saturday, you know, Saturday and Sunday back to back, so that Monday morning it was in.
Yep.
Got the test it needed, because I think we were shipping that Thursday.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that was light.
Game developers.
Okay, so let's have a chat with Stephen. He's been sitting there very patiently. So you did pretty much everything to do with the weapons and the aliens and Race X. Race X is your creation.
Yeah, it was...
except for the little guy, that was Brian.
Yeah, there was Brian Martell and I, you know, did a lot of sketches and drawings for the Race X guys. You know, we wanted them to really look more bug-like and less less like the, you know, what Valve had done. So, you know, we wanted a clear distinction of these guys.
And not to interrupt, but, you know, in early on when I kind of worked out the domain with Mark Laidlaw, who was the minister of kind of the story at the time, we'd agreed to create this race for the purpose of giving... Mark wanted to... people to know that the rift between Earth and alien worlds was much wider than just Zen, that there was a much wider community of other things out there in the universe that could conceivably be connected now that this rift had been torn open, that mankind had figured out how to do this. And so Race X is our domain, and Stephen and Brian designed it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, we used a lot of influences from insects and stuff like that, and just making them kind of cool and really, really bizarre and interesting looking. And we even got to a point, like, we tried to integrate some of that into the weapons. If you remember, the shock roach and the spore launcher were kind of alien weapons. And those were kind of inspired from the, I believe, the Half-Life B-gun and the Snarks, you know.
Well,
so.
The Shockroach was, I wanted the idea that when the alien guy dies, the weapon is alive and feels like a creature.
Yeah.
And then if I want it to feel like it's attacking you, but instead of it hitting you and doing damage, you equip it. And that would be a really surprising moment. And then, but where you really killed it, because the gun itself was like, oh, it just fires a beam, you know, bolt of energy,
right.
Whatever. Where you killed it, it's that spore launch, the animation, where you're...
That's
where,
my favorite
where
animation.
That was
his pet.
I love that.
And
he feeds him the little ammo.
Furs.
Yeah. Feeds it the balls, the spores, yes.
So, bringing that to life was really fun, you know, that one.
Yeah, and the weapons as well. I mean, the barnacle gun, which you guys, you know, Patrick mentioned, that was a cool thing. I didn't feel it was used enough. It was kind of one of those things that I know you can't use it too much because then people get blasé about it, but it just was like, shit, I've got to find places to use this, you know?
Well, we created, when we introduced it, we created some walls, some doors that were unpassable until you discovered it, and then in discovering it, you were able to use it to navigate those environments. And from that point forward, there were strategic places where we test it, but we balanced the tests of the barnacles as frequently as we test all of the other tools that we'd offered at that point. And by that point in the game, you had a lot of tools, right? You had all these different capabilities. So it was a big game as expansion packs go, but it wasn't so big where you're going to be doing nothing but barnacle tests. Having said that, we did the Half-Life Opposing Force CTF, the Capture the Flag multiplayer game. Patrick did almost all of the code for that, I think.
Yeah.
And that game was amazing with the barnacle. Like, using the barnacle,
their entire levels were getting one into the other just with the barnacle gun, never touched the ground.
Yeah.
Had so much fun with that. So good.
I still have fun. I mean, Opposing Force CTF, Once in a Blue Moon, we kind of pull it out of the closet here and just try and get people together to play it. But
really
it's still my favorite CTF.
I think that was the best CTF ever, and it was one of my favorite competitive games ever. So good. That wasn't a project. That was just like we were making it for ourselves and we just shared it with people. Like that there was no like product that it was for. There was no,
I mean, it was pretty much Rob and I just kind of messing around with the stuff.
And I think each of us built a map, right? I built a couple of maps for it, and it's so much fun.
So it sounds like you guys love playing the you know, the games, but what about mods and stuff? I mean, were you playing mods that people had made for Half-Life when you were making Opposing Force and Blue Shift?
Absolutely. In fact, we discovered Counter-Strike. There was a deal that Sierra done with 2015 to make an expansion, and Valve was asking us, dude, what do you think of this? Because it wasn't really working out right. We said, that's not going to work. You need to just get around Counter-Strike because this thing is going to be magic. And that was like pre-Beta 1 when we first started playing Counter-Strike in the office. Do you remember that? It was like so broken back then, but it was so cool. Brian and I were playing that a lot back then.
All right. But, I mean, what about single-player mods, which is, you know, where the real action is?
Yeah, we played everything. You'd have to name some things to trigger... recognition, because recall isn't working right now. Do you guys remember anything?
Oh, we were playing a lot of different games and mods because that's sort of where you that was your application. when I came to Gearbox, everyone's building levels, and I said, okay, you guys need to use Zoner's Half-Life tools because don't use Valve's original tools. There's a guy out there who's making these fantastic tools that all the mod community is using. In fact, consider hiring this guy. And everyone's like, okay, that's interesting. And I get one of the other designers, Dave Mertz, and he starts looking at this going, oh, you're right, we really need to hire this guy. And we come up to Randy and Ball and say, let's get this guy. He's been here ever since.
Yeah, he was on the Expedia team at Microsoft, and he wrote better lighting solvers than Valve did.
Yeah, his tools were fantastic. He became one of our tools guys, but that's sort of where you find the people that you want to work on this thing. Look at people who are doing mods and things. It's a great opportunity for you to see, oh, look, you're capable of shipping something, and you have a certain quality bar, and you're capable of working with other people, because usually you can't do that by yourself. So we were looking at a lot of mods, so it's very easy for us to not remember any one specific.
No, I didn't want to put words into your mouth and give you a list, because that wouldn't be fair. But do you guys know that there's a group of people making remakes of Opposing Force and Blue Shift in Source?
What? You know about that?
The Opposing Force is called Wilson's Chronicles, and the Blue Shift one is called Guard Duty. And, okay, they're not going to be as big as Black Mesa, which was just released, but these guys look like they're doing a good job, so...
That's awesome. Cool, I'd love to see that stuff. I hope they finish it.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be working well. I mean, one of my questions was going to be, have they contacted you? But obviously not, if you don't know anything about it.
I haven't heard anything of you.
No, I mean, I've only heard about the Decay one. Like, I was contacted by guys trying to make Decay on the PC, but I hadn't heard about the other two.
All right. Let's talk about Decay, because some of my readers were really curious to talk about the Dreamcast port of Half-Life. So,
well, Decay,
what happened?
Decay was exclusive to the PlayStation 2 version of Half-Life.
Yeah.
The Blue Shift was originally going to be exclusive to the Dreamcast version of the game, but we pulled it out and made it its own product.
Okay. And what about the Dreamcast version of Half-Life 1?
Yeah, what about it? What do you want to know?
Well, actually, what my readers want to know is, the leaked version, was it final or beta?
I don't know. I haven't scrutinized the leaked version.
It was a final because we never shipped.
I mean,
right.
it did go through cert, though. The game was approved in certification. Okay. And so there was a finished build somewhere, but I don't know. I haven't scrutinized that version, so I can't actually answer that. But if it wasn't final, it's probably close to it. It really, I think the way you tell the difference is how many bugs there are and what the performance is, like what the frame rates are like. If the frame rates are between 20 and 30, if they're all over 20 and there's not really any bugs in it, then it's probably the final version. If the frame rates are a little low, like around 15 to 20 frames per second, it might be before final.
Okay. And did you have any more thoughts, or have you had any more thoughts about going back to Black Mesa at any point in a different kind of sequel?
You know, it's for a while, you know, every once in a while I'd check in with, you know, some of the Valve guys, or they'd check in with me, but we haven't really. I mean, it's actually been a few years since I've thought about that with them. I mean, I'm very fond of Half-Life and very fond of our characters and fond of the time we spent there. But you know, Half-Life is their thing. At the time, the ideas that we brought to the table and what we wanted to do would not have existed but for Gearbox. But today, there's you know, the stewards of that brand, you know, they're dreaming what should happen to it, and you know, I think the collective, the cultural collective interest is there, but there's like I don't feel like a desperate need to scratch an itch, you know what I mean?
Mm. You've got too many other itches that you're scratching already, I take it.
Yeah, we're infected over here. It's kind of gross, really.
So yeah, so there's time is the limiting factor, right? There's so many things to that one could spend its mind share on, and it's difficult to prioritize sometimes.
Okay, so if you could go back in time, and you could redo anything about either of the games, would there be anything, or you're pretty happy with how it turned out?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I'd have to think about that. What about you, Steven?
I'm pretty happy with how they turned out. I thought the game, it was surprisingly good when we were done, for being, you know, first step in Half-Life.
Yeah.
It worked out pretty well.
And how many guys we were, and how long.
Yeah,
we spent,
how small of a team we had, and how quickly we got that done, and all the challenges that we had to overcome. I was really happy at the end. It was, you know, it was a great feeling. And then the follow-up work they did with Blue Shift and Decay and all those other things, I mean, we just kept rolling with that. And I think it was all really good. I think Blue Shift could have been something larger than it was, but we were kind of limited to how big we could really make that.
It was built for one purpose and then released under another purpose. So the size of it is exactly what it should have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you mean? It was, what was it built for then?
It was built for the Dreamcast. It was built to be an extra for the Dreamcast guys, and then we released it as a standalone thing on the PC. But and immediately it became clear, okay, there needs to be more. We don't want to just release it because it's not very long. It's really good and it's really fun, but it's not very long. And the question is, what can we do to add some value to this? But it's also, it had a beginning and middle in it, but really complete. So just sticking in a bunch of random love, make it longer, would have been disingenuous. And the solution was, well, why don't we take some of the new models and new art we did for Dreamcast and release it as sort of
HD pack,
right? Like higher quality models and improve your overall Half-Life experience and improve the graphics of all the enemies and guys. So, you know,
we also included Opposing Force for free in that.
Yeah, and also included Opposing Force for free. So the Blue Shift package turned out to be a really nice deal. But it was built, you know, if we went back in time with the knowledge that the Dreamcast wouldn't be released, then, you know, would we say, this bigger? Can't go back in time with knowledge of the future.
Like, it was also built to leverage a lot of what was already in the game, what was already in Half-Life. I think we introduced the one new NPC scientist, and otherwise...
Otis!
It was at this point that the audio was lost. Please accept my apologies both to you, the listener, and to everybody involved in the interview.
Remember, finishing Half-Life is just the beginning.